Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they have fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News, and once again, we are joined in studio by the UNITV Media Collective crew, and they're going to introduce themselves in a moment, but we want to give you a warm welcome to Your World News / UNITV Media. This is your first time tuning in. You may not know the drill. If you've listened to this show many, many times before, you know the call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, it's 347 845-5191. Of course, you're not obligated to call in. You can sit back and listen and enjoy the ideas and information that are going to be bandied about throughout the show as usual. But feel free if you have any comments or questions, you want to, you know, share some knowledge and wisdom with us, you know, please, by all means, call in the show. And we'll be repeating that call-in number a couple more times throughout the show, but hopefully you've taken a note of it and written it down just in case the urge hits you. And it's a freezing day today, March 12th, 2014, if you're in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And I suspect if you're anywhere north of Washington, D.C., whether it's Baltimore, New York, Philly, it's freezing today, especially we had a, you know, we had a 60-degree day yesterday. But I say all that to say that this is a powerful show. This show is going to heat you up a little bit, and it should heat you up a little bit because it's a very important topic, one that I believe needs to be in constant dialogue right now throughout Black America, throughout you know, the Black world, wherever African people are throughout the world, because we understand that the implications and the residual impacts of colonization and slavery, white supremacy and institutional racism are amongst us, and in many cases they exist within our minds, and it makes it much more difficult for us to defeat you know, the negative impacts of white supremacy and institutional racism, knowing our true selves and marching forward organized in unity, if we still believe that we are in some shape, form, or fashion devalued and less than, you know, our European or white counterparts. And so we're going to get into this show. We're going to get into definitions of blackness. Who defines blackness? Who really defines blackness? And do we need to anyone to validate our blackness? My personal opinion, validation is something for parking. You know, parking tickets. You know, you validate them. And I don't believe that we need to validate ourselves. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of things continue to subsist, and so we have to tackle this question and this topic head on. And so I'm going to turn it over to student producer and host Nellie Netterville. Let her introduce herself, and then we'll go around the room and get this show started. Nellie.
Okay. Well, I am Nellie Netterville, and I just wanted to ask everybody in the room, what does being black mean to you, or what does it mean to be black? And when you
speak,
can you please introduce yourself?
Who wants to take a stab at that first?
I guess I'll go. Hi, my name's Tatiana. What does it mean to be black? To me, I feel like being black means to always have a shadow behind you. You're concerned with being treated differently by both black people and white people. You always have that constant reminder of slavery because of everything that's around you. It also means having pride in your heritage. You know, coming up from slavery, we've come from slavery through Jim Crow, civil rights, and look where we are now. We have a black president in his second term. So, you know, not only the bad, but the good.
Anybody else want to take a stab at that as we go around? Move to town?
I'm Mufta Shinaba, so basically my perception of being black is pretty much the color of my skin. That's just the way that I was created, and I'll always carry that color with me. I'm not ashamed to say that I am black, but here's the problem with it, that they believe black is more of an inferior color tone, like, and not just in terms of skin color, in terms of a lot of other aspects, and I find it dumb to compare these types of aspects, if you want my opinion. So basically, me coming from Nigeria, my parents being from Nigeria, we see both sides of it. We've seen both sides of the struggle, pretty much. And nowadays, me being raised up, me still being young, I see things about black versus white, they still open up to me, no matter what.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hello out there. My name is Malik, and my interpretation of what it means to be black, for me, I think black is a culture. And kind of touching on what Tatiana Mufta'a said before, being black in America is about, first, acceptance, knowing who you are, knowing that you are knowing the traditions and the culture and from the descendants of Africa, and then learning about it, gaining that knowledge of the culture, what makes us unique and separate from every other group in America and in the world, and then having a pride. You got to have pride for being black. When you cultivated those three things, then you really can describe yourself as a black person. And that goes beyond color of your skin and pigmentation.
I like that.
My name is Diamond. I'm a journalism major. And to me, being black is not just about the tone of your skin or being of African descent. But it's like Tatiana said, like, it's a unique experience to be black. So I think that being black is living and experiencing the daily struggle of being black, because it is a struggle. It's also taking pride, like you said, taking pride and embracing being black.
The way I see it, to me, being black is, it's nothing that you can just adopt. You have to be born into and it doesn't depend on your skin color. They have very extremely passing for white black people, and they have the extremely dark, almost actually black people. So it's a very all-encompassing word. It doesn't just mean that you're from America and you're black. You can be from Africa and be black. You can be from the Caribbean and be black. You can be from Europe and be black. It's all-encompassing of all people that have an African descent somewhere in them, and it shows through their skin. And it's also a culture, like it was already said, is we have different things that we do, just the way we raise our children, the way we go about initiating relationships, both friendships and romantic relationships, the way we go about food, our eating habits, our entertaining. We're just different from the very beginning. And it shouldn't really be about the way you speak or the color of your skin, how light you are, how dark you are, that determines how black you are, because you're born into it and you can't get away from it.
I like that. I like what everyone says, has said, you know, thus far. And I think that if you are black, it should be understood, especially if you know, you're deemed an African American, the first part of that hyphenated term is African. So our culture, without a doubt, resonates, you know, throughout the continent of Africa. And obviously, you know, being, you know, ripped to having our ancestors ripped away and brought to different parts of the so-called New World, and we understand it wasn't new to indigenous people, whether you were Taino or Arawak or Lakono or Apache. These people had been living here, these indigenous people, so-called Native Americans, Carib from Trinidad, they had been living here for thousands and thousands of years. And so I think that when you start to adopt that kind of language that, oh, when Christopher Columbus discovered America, you are allowing yourself to accept some very white supremacist ideologies. White supremacy the most innocuous version of white supremacy is the guy walking around with a swastika, you know, in the side of his head. We've been programmed to see, you know, somebody that has a sheet over their head or a hood over their head as that's white supremacy, and then trained not to see things that we go on and that we've been trained to worship, things that are completely against not just our value system, but if you were green and you were a good human being, against that person's value system. If you are calling George Washington, or, you know, you're one of your founding fathers, that is a man that owned, you know, over 300, you know, 300 African slaves. I mean, Christopher Columbus. I mean, what he did, you know, to indigenous people throughout what's now known as the Caribbean and a part of South America and parts of Central America. He never stepped foot on North America, and then being the biggest cheerleader for the African one of the biggest cheerleaders for the African slave trade, and to, you know, to be trained to, like, worship this guy or celebrate this guy every second Monday of October is also a completely white supremacist, you know, ideology. And so we seem to know everyone else's culture, even aspects of other people's culture that, quite frankly, I would say, spit in the face of what our ancestors went through. But we've been trained not to run as far away from, you know, various aspects of our Africanness, you know, and we know that being an African American, there's also a culture within a culture, right? There's a culture, you know, you're from down south, and there's a culture, you know, down south, with black folks down south, you know, how they celebrate, how they do things, you know, being in New Orleans and how they celebrate, not mourn, but how they celebrate when somebody passes away, and it's a going home party of sorts. These are all things and so much more that we could never confine into one show, that it means to be black, you know, but I'll end on this, but at the heart of it, I think that you have to embrace in some shape, form, or fashion that you are African, and there's a lot of beauty of that. I mean, Africa, the continent of Africa, various, you know, parts of Africa were at their apex for 3,000 years. Think about that. The U.S. has only been around for as a country settled by white Europeans, but you know, the United States itself, what, 237 years. And you think about Egypt, Kemet, 3,000 years. We're talking about things that came out of Africa, like the great universities, one of the first universities, University of Sankore in Mali, iron ore, this, you know, wind, the derivation of windows, soap, all this kind of stuff came out of Africa. But we've been programmed not to see that beauty, because when you see that beauty, you see beauty in yourself, and you look at yourself no matter how dark you are or how light you may be, because we represent a whole spectrum of things, but we're taught not to see that beauty as a number one priority. We you know, if anything, it may be tertiary or down on the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to our list of priorities. But once we see the beauty in ourselves, then we start to see the beauty in our community. Then we start to come together and to move mountains and stop some of these systematic social issues that still plague us today, police brutality and the like. So,
going off of that, one of the things that I've always thought about ever since I was like a little girl, because I grew up in the suburbs. My family's originally from Southside Chicago, but I was raised in Atlanta, and I was raised in the suburbs of Atlanta. And growing up, I always wanted to know, like, what I really didn't understand white supremacy. I saw movies like Higher Learning, where they paint like this really, really horrific picture of a white supremacist and all this stuff. But I really didn't understand it. But I did understand that there were two different cultures that I lived in. I lived in like this suburban area where I did go to school with a nice percentage of white people. But then my family back home in Chicago lived around nothing but white people. I mean, nothing but black people. You couldn't really find a white person. It was really hard. And there was definitely a difference between the two. The way I lived and the way they lived, like just the way they carried out their lives, it was like two different types of scenarios. But we were still black. We were still from the exact same family. And it was just kind of like the divide in the community was very strong. And I wasn't quite sure if it was a white supremacist divide on my end, because I grew up around all of these people that were white, or if it was just like a deeper penetrating essence in Southside Chicago. But I really wasn't sure. Did anybody else have that type of sensation growing up, or realization growing up?
No, I grew up in all black neighborhoods. So when I came to Maryland, this is literally the most white, or any culture I've ever seen, ever. Like, I grew up in the inner city.
You say Baltimore, right?
Yeah. So I've never experienced having that divide between different cultures until now.
Right.
I used to live in Burbank, Van Nuys, Reseda, California, right in the Hollywood Valley, Los Angeles. And I lived there from like 4 months old to 8. My mom used to work out there. And so for the most part, my school... I remember in preschool, I was the only black kid in my preschool, and so my best friend showed up, and it was two of us, and we were too strong. And then after that, I went to kindergarten, I went to another old school, and I was pretty much only black in my class. And And in my neighborhood, I was the only black kid in my neighborhood, and all my friends are white. And I remember, I would go out, and I'd hang out with all the white people, and it was normal to me because I didn't have any black people. It was just the normal thing. It's what I grew up in, and I didn't ever think about it. I was maybe just the black kid at that time. And so I learned all the white stuff. I could skateboard, I can BMX, I can super scooter, whatever, all that junk.
Mm.
And then when I was 8, my parents decided we were going to move back to Prince George's County, Maryland, the blackest place in America. And I come back here, and I went from being the only black kid in my school to being one of every black kid in my school. And there was nobody that went to, like, Potomac Landing Elementary School. If anyone knows it, it's all black people. It's like 3% other. And it was an incomplete culture shock for me because I had never experienced so many black people in my life, and I didn't know how to react. I didn't know how to talk to other black people. I didn't know, the traditional, the culture was absent for me because I didn't have that experience. People had these funny words I didn't know. Maryland has so many weird words. PG, Baltimore, they all have our own language, and I didn't understand any of it. So people told me they were going to steal me, and I was like, what are you taking from me? It was crazy, and so I had to. It took me a long time, and a lot of times I came to conflict because I came from California, so I had perfect diction. I used four syllable words, buck words, and they said I talk white, and I was so shocked, and I was like, I don't even know what that means. I just talk the way I was taught, and that hurt me for a long time. But I had to learn to grow into that. Now I can Joan like the best of them.
Right. I just want to say something real quick, and I know Mutal has something to say, but if I can just interject, man, I'm really appreciate your candor and what you just said. And Nelly and I had this conversation, I believe, perhaps maybe a week ago, when we were having this conversation, we're talking about young folks who will say to folks like yourself, because you're speaking articulately that you're talking white. And the sad thing about that is that they might say to you that, you're not black enough because you have this diction, this proper diction or you're using these large, these multi-syllable words and so forth. But the crazy thing is that shows that showcases how white supremacy, them saying that is the residual impact of white supremacy, because we have to remember that what our ancestors went through. I mean, it wasn't just that you could get whipped for being caught trying to teach yourself or trying to teach other people to read. You could lose your life. You could literally lose your life. And there were people that lost their lives learning how to read and write. And then you have folks like Frederick Douglass, who is known today, this day, is not black or white or green, but known as one of the greatest orators this country has ever known. All right, and he happens to be somebody who was born into slavery, absconded, escaped from slavery, and largely really, ameliorated his speaking skills, so when someone says that to me, that's an anti-black, that's one of the most anti-black things you can say, because really your mind is not yours, but when they're saying that to you, their mind is colonized, their mind is still in those shackles, they're still in those shackles, and it's almost like my response to them would be it's almost like you're cheerleading for that white man in those sheets. It's you're cheerleading for that slave master of our ancestors. What are you talking about? Well, don't you know that we were prevented from reading and writing? So if I'm here and I say a word that you may not know, brother, sister, take an opportunity. I'm not gonna come down hard. I'm not gonna make fun of you. Ask me what that word means. We can engage in that. Because as Malcolm said, the great Malcolm X said, El Haj Malik El Shabazz said, he said, we can't get on people for not knowing something, because at one point of our lives, everything that we know, we didn't know. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but you weren't the one that was being anti-black or anti-African. Unfortunately, they were. They were still confined in those mental shackles.
And that's their grave.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm going to take a different perspective on this. Pretty much, my family coming from Nigeria, so basically in the early years of elementary school, I was always trying to blend in with my friends and whatnot. But also, whenever my mom and dad decided that there were days in which I wanted to dress up in traditional culture, we had the lace, we had the ankara, we had all this, like all these exotic things, like things that I'm now proud of. I didn't know till now. And when I wore them to school, people were asking, like, what the hell am I wearing? Like, I'm telling them, I'm wearing my native Africa, and they would look at me funny with pretty much. If I even try to say something, even in Yoruba, they would say I would talk nonsense and not talking. I'm thinking that's just a detriment of not knowing where we came from, pretty much. Like basically, if they taught us anything about Africa, it would probably be the negative connotation or just geographic location. And that's it.
Well, me, my mother is Trinidadian. My father, he was raised in Detroit and in Atlanta. So coming from one side of my family, I have that extreme culture and something that a lot of people in the South, I grew up in Georgia, a lot of people in the South aren't used to. But my mother, she kept us in really good schools and all of that. So I was mostly, growing up, I was mostly in half white, half black, probably not half, but you know. I grew up around both white people and black people, Indian people, Asian people. Then one year I remember going to live with my father. He lived in Charlotte at the time, Charlotte, North Carolina. And I went to school in a predominantly black neighborhood, nothing but black and Hispanic people. And I grew up reading and loving to read. I was in the reading bowl team and people would be like, what is that? Like all this kind of stuff. And the kids would be like, oh, Tatiana, Aaliyah, you speak so white. You know, I feel like black people are considering, and not only black people, all people are considering race with your actions, how you act. So you can be a white girl, and you're over here twerking and talking Ebonics, and, oh, you're black because of your actions, you know. That's what I really think that's the problem here.
Going off of what everybody just said, I think that basically encompasses all. I don't want to say that it's anti-black. I want to say that it's just that there's a disconnect in between the different inner cultures within the black culture, within the larger black culture. Because there is, I feel like a lot of the black culture that says, oh, that's white, or that's too African, I feel like they're just stuck in their own culture and in their own subculture and don't want to experience anything outside. I wouldn't call that anti-black. I just call that hyper-black. It's kind of like what was going on in the beginnings of the civil rights, and they just did not want anything to do with anybody but black people. It's kind of like that. I think that they just don't understand it. They're just not educated enough to grasp it, or they just don't want to grasp it. They just want to stay within themselves. I went through school myself being known as the wannabe white Aaliyah. Because of the way I wore my hair and I guess the way I look, they said that I wanted to be Aaliyah, but I was white because of the way I talked. And my mom even told me, I went home recently, my mom was saying that my voice has changed since I was a little girl because I've adopted an accent. I didn't really notice it. She was like, you've adopted an accent, but it's mainly because of the way they treated you in, like, middle school. They would call you white all the time, and all of a sudden you just started dropping the R's on the end of your words. And I didn't even notice I had done that, but I guess she's right. I was trying to blend in. I was trying to become more black, but I was always black. Like I said, I was born in Southside Chicago. I can't hide it. The skin, if you see me, I am black. There's no doubt about it. But like Tatiana said, your actions are being attached to who you are. Robin Thicke was nominated to be black now. The white community gave him up. I heard that on the radio. people like Sean Paul, who is from Jamaica, but is very, very on more like a different side, on an other side of a Jamaican heritage, people would definitely consider him black. Somebody like, I'm not sure, but there's just different cultures are always being compared to be black or not black based off of the way they speak, based off of the way they dress, based off of the way their body looks. Like, if you don't have the big boobs or the big butt, then you're not black enough. Well, if you're not a size 5 by the time you reach a certain age, then you're obviously not black. You have too much white blood in you or something like that. And that's just not right to me. There's too many different facets of the black community and of the black culture for us to just ignore them and just say that this is what black is here. And I think that's where the divide and the disconnect is. And yes, I do believe it stems from slavery, but right now the people that are doing it don't know it stems from slavery. The people that are doing it don't see it as something that's coming from slavery. The people that are doing it have a complete disconnect from that completely. And it's just about how they're feeling right now, what they were taught. Like Muftau said, when we were taught Africa, the continent of Africa, I probably spent like maybe 2 weeks on it in school. And you spend like a good like a semester on Europe. So it's kind of like we don't get to be taught these things. People don't know about Billie Holiday or Madam C.J. Walker or people know George Washington Carver. That's the one person they do know.
They don't know what he did, but they just remember the name.
But it's kind of like they don't know all of these great, rich people that come out of our culture that, if you really want to say it, talked white. Martin Luther King talked white. If you're going to say somebody talked white, he wouldn't be able to get up on stage and talk to the vast array of people and have presidents standing behind him.
But he wasn't talking white.
The standards today. I'm not saying there is no such thing as talking white. That's my whole point. Yeah. So the standards today, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all of our civil rights leaders talked white, basically, except for maybe the black standards.
And make sure you say that because people on the radio don't put quote-unquote white. So you're saying quote-unquote white, yeah. Because those standards. And I agree to a certain extent, and I respectfully disagree on... I think that, for instance, when you hear Malcolm say, because I think that it is anti-black. They may not know it, and so when you say like the education, that when you don't get that education and you get a certain kind of education. So for instance, we know historically that when Africans were brought over here, they were domesticated like dogs. We were domesticated like dogs. They didn't just prevent us from playing the drums and learning to read and write because they were just trying to be mean. It was because they wanted to eviscerate any culture that we had prior. Because once you domesticate somebody, you rip them of their that great scene in Roots when he was whipping him and saying, "What's your name? Your name's Toby. No, I'm Kunta Kinte. Say your name is Toby." They needed him to be Toby. Just like they needed us to be nigger. They needed us because if you are anything but nigger or anything but Toby, you are a threat down the line, all right, to their power structure. Because you can break down somebody physically, but if you have a whole mass, millions and millions of people that you are enslaving, and they still have that mental capacity, they still have their culture, they still are proud, a prideful people, then they are a threat. They are a threat to organize. They are a threat to stand up. And so when somebody says that, their first thing is to say, you're talking white. Where did you get that? See, that's the whole thing I want folks to think about is when somebody tells you that because you're articulate, that's saying that they expect you. There is an expectation level that has been set forth that black people are supposed to be inarticulate. Where did you get that? Where did you get that? That has been passed down. That has been passed down all the way from the 1800s and the 1600s. You're supposed to be inarticulate because we prevented you from learning how to read and write. All right? Because we prevented you. And then once, masses of you, were freed after, during Reconstruction and so forth, we know a whole bunch of you couldn't read or write. So you were going up there and speaking, your own dialect, this, that, and the other, and because, we, the white man, couldn't understand it, so you know, therefore, you know, you start to get these labels, and obviously, and folks couldn't read or write because they were, you know, many of them were prevented from reading or writing. Where did that come from? And so that we see that thing that was in your documentary, Diamond, where Malcolm was saying that when he was addressing those folks. Where did you get that? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin? Who taught you to hate your hair? Who taught you that? That comes from somewhere. So people may not know. They may not be consciously saying. So I get what you're saying. They may not consciously say, I'm saying it to Malcolm, and I'm being anti-black because I'm rejecting blackness. In their mind, their whole notion of blackness and what they believe they understand about blackness is a notion about blackness that has been fed to them by folks who don't give a damn about them or their community or their culture in any shape, form, or fashion. That's why, as Janelle said, that history is not provided to us. And if it is provided to this very limited faction, so George Washington Carver is known as the guy who created peanut butter, but folks don't know that he created 300 different uses of the peanut, the pecan, and the sweet potato. You know what I'm saying? So that is all by design. That's all by design. You know, when you look at our Native American brothers and sisters, what do we think that the Indian schools that they forced them into were for? They changed their name from Billy Nighthawk to, you know, William Jennings or something like that. You know what I'm saying? That was all based around social control, and it is a model. It's a blueprint that works. You rip some people away from their culture. You prevent them from reading or writing. That is a blueprint for keeping them enslaved for such a long time. And I'll end on this. It was, you know, that's where the whole thing, like, wow, you know, if you're escaping from the plantation, you've got to be crazy. We're going to call it drapetomania. Because you're what's got into these Negroes escaping from the plantation? They gotta be crazy, And you know what they did to prevent them from the prescription for these crazy enslaved Africans who had the audacity to run away from an oppressive plantation? They would cut their big toes off on both feet to make it difficult to run. That's what was done. They would cut their, and that was a scientific prescription. That's what you do. For all those wacky charlatan scientists that bought into the science of Samuel Cartwright, they said, you got to clip their toes. Clip their big toes. Prevent them from running.
One of the things that made me think about is I'm still not too sold on the idea of anti-black, mainly because I know so many people that think from this type of point of view. Like I said, I understand completely where you're coming from. I understand the facts. I understand the background. But to me, it might even be like understanding the background and taking it into a different effect. Instead of being anti-black, can't it be hyper-black? Like, I don't want to be anything like the white man.
But how can you be hyper-black if you don't know what blackness is?
There's a different culture. We have a completely different culture because the African culture was stripped from the black American. From the African American, the African culture was stripped. So you can't even compare African culture to the African American community in America. It's two different cultures now. Period. Absolutely. There's just we can argue about why that is all the time for a really, really long time. But that won't settle the fact that it's different. We just have two different cultures, and I'm pretty sure Mutal could attest to this. Like, there's two different cultures between a Nigerian here and somebody that was born, raised in PG County. Their whole entire family was born and raised in PG County. There's two different...
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah,
I mean, you can say
that
about any people,
so
though.
So that's what I'm saying.
You can say that about white people who were Jewish that immigrated from Russia that live in Israel right now.
But that's two different cultures. So you can't compare the African culture and say that this is the reason why.
I didn't say anything about African culture.
I know.
I didn't even say anything about African culture, even though, you know, the aspects, when you go down south where you're from, things that black folks do down south come from Africa. There are certain things that they do come from Africa. That's undeniable. You know the history. Things when you see black folks doing certain things that are in New Orleans, and you look what tribes, you know what I'm saying, were predominantly brought in there, those are layovers that were brought over, that were brought, because they found ways. You know, our ancestors found ways when they were in their plantation, you know, huts and so forth, they found ways to get around to try to, you know, practice, you know, certain things. So if you were Igbo or Yoruba or what have you, you know what I'm saying, when you look at even like the voodoo, you know what I'm saying, where is that? You know where that comes from. That comes from, you know, the west coast of Africa. know what I'm saying? So they found ways to practice, you know, aspects of their spiritual things and their religion. But I'm talking about when somebody says, you know, they may not be thinking it, but if you were telling, that's like almost like, you know, if I just, you know, keep, you know, oppress a whole bunch of women, you know what I'm saying? And then, you know, start to say, like, this is you. And then afterwards, like, generations down the line, you know what I'm saying, I have them acting like, you know, quote-unquote what a man, you know, acts like or so forth. I've, in essence, reconditioned and reprogramming. So they may not know that, but what I'm saying, it's a detriment. And to me, that was an effective way, because I had that address when I was in college. But to me, that was the most effective way. If I would have come to them, to folks that said that to me, said the same thing they said to you when you were in third grade, that were said to me when I was a sophomore in college, and that, like I said, after my sophomore year, it stopped when I brought it up like this. I said, and I broke it down. I said it to the brother just exactly what I just told you. That, you know what I'm saying, I'm trying to tell you, like, and there was a bunch of us around. He didn't dare say anything in rebuttal. I mean, it opened up a whole can of worms for a discussion that was laid out. And I don't ever remember that brother ever saying that, well, he didn't say it to me, but to anybody ever again. I think that it probably put him in a position of retrospect. Malcolm talks about that, how, you know what I'm saying, how he was enlightened to change, you know what I'm saying, once he was, you know, exposed to various aspects of his culture and, you know, through his parents' Garveyism and all these other things. So, I hear what you're saying. I just think that we have to move, like, the conversation around how many of us derive. I mean, Diamond just did a documentary on colorism, and there was a bunch of folks in the documentary that were candid that said, yeah, you know, I was told not to date any boys, you know, that were dark like you or darker than me. I mean, this is not just a snapshot. Unfortunately, this is going on throughout America. It goes on throughout Africa because colonization hit Africa just as slavery, you know what I'm saying? So there are a lot of experiences that are shared between continental Africans and African Americans. You know, so we saw that, right, in the documentary? Where did they get that? You know what I'm saying? Somewhere inside you, something causes you to dislike who you are, to say, okay, I'm light, Diamond, you're darker than me, I'm better than you. That's ugly. That's ugly because you're so many shades darker than me. I mean, it's not true, but what is it then? If it's not being anti-black, what is that?
I'm sorry, you didn't let me actually finish my statement. I was going to say that it's hyper-black, meaning that they don't want to be considered anything but black. They want to be within their own self. They don't want to have any type of traits that look anything like the white man. That's what I was trying to say. I don't think that it's anti-black. Like, I'm trying to keep you down with me. I think it's like, I don't want our people should not be anything like them. Don't try to talk like them. Don't try to dress like them, because we are black, and if you're trying to do that, that means that you really don't want to be a part of our community, thus you're trying to be an Oreo. That's where I think these people that are saying you talk white are coming from. I don't think they're coming from an anti-black point.
All of them? You don't think any of them? Because I agree with you. Maybe some of them are not.
I don't
but
think,
to
I would
place
probably
a broad-based
say,
thing and
I
say
would
all
probably
of them.
Say 90% at least.
That, you know what? I hope you get your, if you're going to get your PhD, that would be a good study to do. That would be a good study to do, because that's something that obviously we can't, until we do like some survey methodology. I mean, I would bet that it would at the very least be closer to 50-50. But until there's some kind of expansive, you know, study, like the study that the married couple, the name eludes me, the brother and, you know, sister, like well, they weren't brother and sister. When I say brother and sister, the brother and sister, married couple that did the black doll, white doll. When you have these little black girls, like, honestly, where does that come from? That comes from, you know, you have been taught to, when you see something that looks like you, you see it as negative. And when you see something that is white, that reflects everything that you see and have been taught on TV and society, you see that as the pretty doll. We see that as the pretty doll. And that scientific study that they did, and then they revisited it, what, it was like 7 years ago, the same exact results. The same exact results. And so, you know, until we start to, like, move towards, like, solutions to address these things, the results will be the same in 20 years, and 20 years down the line, you know. And I think regardless of who you are, whatever your hue or your culture is, that you should see yourself as beautiful. And so I think it's a travesty when you have young boys and young girls who see themselves as less than.
So I was going to say, like, I agree with what you're saying, obviously. You know, I've done a lot of research on it. But I can also see where she's coming from based on my own personal experience. Because I've been on the other side. I have a family where if somebody's talking, if somebody's speaking really proper, why are you talking like, my brother, he went to, not private, county schools his whole life. I've been to inner city schools in Baltimore my whole life. So I talk to, like, my whole family, but my brother, when he starts talking, you know, really proper, why are you talking like, my aunt, she talks pretty proper, so they're like, why are you talking like that, you know? So, and even my friends, if I go back home, like, spring break, and I start talking like this, they're going to be like, what is it, like, what are you doing? Like, I kind of had to switch it on and off for them, like, you know, because they're going to be like, what are you, like, who are you trying to, you know, act like that in front of, like, you know? So I can see where she comes when she's talking about that whole culture and that whole hyper black thing, because it is real. Like, and I think that in my case, like, it would be something really good to study, because in my case, I think it is hyper black with my family, because even my mother has been, like, you know, like, not too fond of white people, you know. So it's kind of like a backlash, like, based on her experiences and based on the past of our culture, you know. So it's kind of like we want to be as far away from white as possible, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I have to agree with what you're saying based on what I experienced and based on what I've heard.
And not just, language.
It's not just language.
Avoiding anything white. Mm-hmm. Like, brothers, you know, growing up saying they want to, let's say, hockey. I don't know any brothers who play hockey. Well, there's not a lot of them, but I'm pretty sure there's been some brothers around who've grown up and seen hockey and say, I want to do that. And they went to their boys and they say, why would you play that? That's a white sport.
Yeah.
No, son, take this basketball. That,
yeah.
You know, that divide where you push yourself
away. Basically, I get that with the members of my family as well, pretty much, in terms of why am I talking this way and whatnot. But I do remember a quote from Malcolm X. Best I can say, if the white man takes away what you're doing, they act like you haven't done anything, right? So basically, and that basically just ties to the ignorance of what it is to actually be black. And the problem is, the result is, you get this ignorance of you're supposed to be a certain type, and what's it called? Nowadays, not getting the light skin versus dark skin debate, pretty much. Now it's spread like wildfire. It's no longer, what's it called, just a debate. It's become, what's it called, a construct, pretty much.
Yeah.
I feel like by us, and when I say us, I mean black people as a whole, by us saying that, what Malik was saying, with the hockey situation, by us doing that to ourselves, we're setting ourselves back, you know? We're saying, I shouldn't do this because only white people do that. We're setting ourselves back. How come you can't be the first black person to be in that club? How come you can't be that black guy that they know as, he's really bombing hockey, yo? Like, you know what I'm saying? Why can't, you know, we're setting ourselves back, and we can't continue to do that to our culture, our people.
We do it to ourselves, though. Because, and then the crazy thing, the very ironic thing is, we love to sit up there and say, and applaud the first black person that wins something for doing something. We love to, like, the Jamaican bobsledders, ooh, yay, like, but black people don't sled, that's a white thing to do. It's like, you know what I mean? It's kind of like swimmers and, it's just, there's so many white activities that you're not really supposed to do.
Quote-unquote.
My little brother's a baseball player, and if you are on any type of baseball team that's not in a black area, you'll know very soon, just by pictures of the team, that there are very few black people on baseball teams. But, I mean, my brother loves baseball with a passion. That is his passion. He loves it. He's been playing baseball ever since he's like 5 years old. And my brother is very black, but he plays a white activity. So, I mean, it's just ironic. We applaud somebody for being the first black person to do something, but then we look down on them before they get this recognition.
Yeah, I think it's just not a conscious thing. Like, I'm not saying, like, that's, like, it's right to say, you know, why are you talking like that? Why are you doing this? Like, that's a white man's sport, or that, you know. I'm not saying that's right, but there's not a consciousness there, you know. So, like, the same way make fun of, like, somebody for being too black or, you know, like, too dark-skinned or too this or too that, in the same way we're still pushing them away from being white. Like, we're still saying, why are you talking like, why are you doing that? So it's kind of it's like night and day. I don't know.
It's hard to be black. Honestly, it really is hard to be black because not only do we have to fight with the white folks to get somewhere in life, it's even life. We have to fight with ourselves. We have to fight with our own brothers and our own sisters just to be accepted within our own community, whether it be the color of our skin, the texture of our hair, the diction that we speak with, the pitch that we speak in. I know my grandma said something about, like, the different pitch or level that you speak in has something to do with you talking white or not. She didn't say it as an insult, but, I mean, like, she just said that just you have more of an airy voice. Black people tend to have a bass in their voice, then, you know.
It's a shame, though, because you see white people, Asian people, they probably don't even know that next white person, but mm-hmm. they will help them out. You know, oh, I have a cousin that's in construction. I'll give him a call, and we can see about getting you something. But black people, they, oh, no, I'm not going to hold the door for him. Oh, I'm not going to keep that train door open for you. For what? I don't know you, you know. And that's a shame, because I feel like if we help our people out, we would be so far in life.
And I like what you said, and I mean, that's the great thing about it is that, you know, you have folks that are going in the same trajectory I know everyone in this room is in the same trajectory, trying to go to the same place. Sometimes you have different vehicles and different perspectives, and so I think it's healthy to have the debate. So, like, Janelle and I may differ on certain things. I'm going to take it to my grave that I think that you know, folks have a false sense of what it means to be black, you know, because, you know, there's some certain things that folks will say that, you know, hating on somebody because they're darker or lighter or this, that, and the other. I mean, you have a false sense of, and you know, it's important, as a researcher does, you have to get to the root cause of that. I mean, that's what social scientists do. But, like, even looking at things like baseball, like, that's because we are so devoid of our history, and that's where, like, shows of these are so important. But also what's important is that you guys taking this to your dorm rooms and spreading it with your, I mean, that's what the likes of Malcolm and Mark, they were taking this to communities, and they were having these dialogues. Malcolm would post up, because I don't think it's enough just to say, I like Malcolm. I mean, I've said it a million times to young people, to college students, because it was said to me coming up, they're like, yo, young brother, it's not just good enough to wear the X hat. Those were things were really popular when I was coming up, the X hat. It's not just to say that you are like Malcolm. What do you know about him? What do you know about his philosophies? Learn about his philosophies, then come back and tell me, do you still embrace the man? So then I did. I was like, damn, I really do embrace the man, because the dude would post up on 125th for 4, 5, 6 hours holding forth, teaching the people about themselves and their history. And so we look at even, like, these sports that we've been taught to think, whatever, here's a nugget of black history, is that at one time in this country, the number one employer for black people nationwide was the Negro Leagues. The Negro Leagues. And to take it a step further, so we talk about, you know, that strong brother Jackie Robinson for integrating and, you know, and going up there and busting butt, you know what I'm saying, you know, in baseball. But the other part of the story is that owners of the Negro Leagues, they asked if they could bring their teams, their squads, into the major leagues. Those white owners across the board, except for one, said, no way. Uh-uh, we're not revenue sharing. Nah. What we're going to do is we're going to cherry pick one after the other, maybe a dozen in a couple years, and we're going to start taking more and more of that talent, bringing it into our league. And you know what happened? Because when you think about the number one employer, the Negro Leagues, we're not talking about just baseball players. We're talking about vendors, groundskeepers. You know, women were employed by the Negro Leagues. All this, and once that started, once that huge exodus occurred, the Negro Leagues folded. But we dominated. You talk about Josh Gibson and Big Cool Papa Bell, Satchel Paige. They all came to the Negro Leagues. They were, you know what I'm saying? Josh Gibson is known as a much better home run hitter than Babe Ruth ever was. But he was black, so he didn't get that. You know what I'm saying? So this is part of our legacy. Baseball, and another thing, jockeys. we've had black jockeys win the Kentucky Derby. The award that goes every single year to the number one jockey in America is known as the Isaac Murphy Award. Know who Isaac Murphy was? He was a black jockey. So then if you don't know your history, then that's when you can even come duped. You know, not us, but like some folks saying, oh, why are you doing that white man sport? But really, if you know your history, like, brother, are you kidding me? We've been riding horses for as long as we've been enslaved. That's how they used to bet. When we were slaves, they would put us on horses and have us race around, and they would put bets. And they would say, in their language, they'd say, I got it on that nigga. My nigga's going to win. My nigga, that buck right there, he's going to win. So we've been riding horses for a long time. And so then when slavery ended, we were skilled, and you had the likes of Isaac Murphy coming in there, winning the Kentucky Derby. You know what I'm saying? That's history. And you know your history. You know it's a part of our DNA. And so I think that's a good transition to go to a break. And this is Lupe, All Black Everything.
Sometimes you just gotta go.
You'll never know what you could ever be. If you never try, you'll never see. Say that Africa may never leave. So the windows play, and I have to read. When a spaceship, when no misery. Call me crazy, or isn't he? See, I fell asleep, and I had a dream. It was all black, everything.
We ain't get exploited. White man ain't here, so he did not destroy it. We ain't work for free, see they had to employ it. Built it up together so we equally appointed. First 400 years, see we actually enjoyed it. Constitution written by W.E.B. Du Bois. When no reconstruction, civil war got avoided. Little black Sambo grows up to be a lawyer. Extra, extra, on the newsstand. Black woman voted head of Ku Klux Klan. Malcolm Little died as an old man. Martin Luther King read the eulogy for Ham. Followed by Bill O'Reilly who read from the Koran. President Bush sends condolences from Iran. Where Fox News reports lie that Ahmadinejad died when the Mandela Peace Prize.
You never know what you could ever be. If you never try, you'll never see. Say that Africa may never leave. So the windows play and I have to read. When a slave ship or no misery. Call me crazy or isn't he? See, I fell asleep and I had a dream. It was all black, everything.
And it ain't no project. Keeping it real's not an understood concept. Yeah, complexion's not a contest. Cause racism is no context. Hip-hop ain't got a section called conscious. Everybody rapping like crack never happened. Crips never occurred, no blood to attack then. Matter of fact, no hood to attack in. Somalia's a great place to relax in. Fred Astaire was the first to do a backspin. The Rat Pack was a cool group of black men that inspired five white guys called the Jackson. Eminem fitted in, but then again, he inspired a black rapper trying to mimic him. And that's really Rosa out of Michigan, a sign of white rapper by the name of Peter Skin.
You never know what you could ever be. If you never try, you will never see. Say that Africa may never leave. So the windows play, and I have to read. When a slave ship, when no misery. Call me crazy, or isn't he? See, I fell asleep, and I had a dream. It was all black, everything.
And I know this is a fantasy. I cordially invite you to ask, why can it be? Now we can't do nothing about the past, but we can do something about the future that we have. We can make it fast or we can make it last. Every woman queen and every man a king. And when those color lines come, we can't see between. We just close our eyes till it's all black, everything.
You never know what you could ever be. If you never try, you will never see. Say that Africa may never leave. So the windows play, and I have to read. When a slave ship, when no misery. Call me crazy, or isn't he? See, I fell asleep, and I had a dream. It was all black, everything.
Color and what that means in being black and everything. I know we touched on a little bit about the Barbie doll. I can remember growing up, and there was no such thing as a white doll in my house, period. Not if it was painted on a coloring book, if it was the actual doll, if it was somebody bringing a friend's doll over. No, no white dolls in my house. I could not have a white Barbie. I had a black Barbie curtain sheet. My mom would go through hell and high water trying to find black Barbie stuff because it actually really was not easy to find back in the 90s at all. But I can remember my mom doing that because my mom was like, no, you are black. You have a black Barbie. I had a Puerto Rican Barbie too, but I'm not Puerto Rican, but, you know, I just had one of those just to keep it diverse, I guess. But I mean, I'm pretty sure the other girls in the room can kind of see where I'm coming from and kind of have their own background and, like, the dolls and what your parents instilled in you at a young age about, like, what you're supposed to be looking at and what you're supposed to be considering beautiful as a black woman.
Okay, I'll go ahead and go. Growing up, my father was very, I don't want to say harsh, but, well, yeah, I guess for it, because I remember I was really young. He used to talk to us like we were very much older. So he let us know, Tatiana, Aaliyah, Dominique, y'all are black females growing up. You know what I'm saying? So you have to know. And we're just like, okay, Daddy. like, you know, and I don't remember ever having a black Barbie doll. I could be wrong, but, you know, I had the Anastasia Barbie doll, stuff like that. But it was never like, oh, white people are, or white girls are prettier than I am. You know, I saw white people growing up, and I saw black girls growing up, and it was just like, okay, we all just girls. But my father made it clear, you're a black person, you're a black girl. So just know, and he let us, you know, he'd make us watch movies, and even if we're just watching a cartoon, he'd come back and be like, okay, so let me tell you about this. You know, what did you get out of this? And we're just like, Daddy, it was just Elmo. Like, you know, it was just Anastasia. It was just Cinderella. But no, let me tell you about this. And I think that was very important for me to go through, because as I got older, I was able to see, okay, I understand now why he did this.
I had a different experience. I was never told not to do this and not to look at that, or, well, probably because I didn't have cable too, but as a child, like, I had a bunch of white dolls. I have a bad memory, but I don't remember, I can't pinpoint a black doll, you know. Probably a big reason of that is probably because it wasn't, like you said, it wasn't really available, and probably because I had really young parents, so they weren't that conscious either. They were still teenagers themselves, so. But now that I can see my mother telling my baby sister, like, you know, about her doctor stuff and, you know, that came out. And then the black princess now, what was her name? Tatiana. Yeah, so now we take a special interest in, you know, getting black dolls. But growing up, I really didn't experience that.
I just want to chime in. I have two little sisters. They're 16 now. They're 16 now. They're twins. So the oldest one is named Milana, the youngest one is Misha. And they have cerebral palsy, but as a whole, totally different thing. So my parents would always buy my sister dolls, my Milan doll. She loved Barbie. She still does. She's like her aunt. She wants to collect them until she's old and gray. But I remember it just for me, when I was younger and I watched my sister play with dolls and I watched her Barbie doll collection grow, and I remember going to the toy store in the 90s. I remember looking around in the Barbie station. I remember not seeing the many black girl Barbies. But what I most remember is how my sister, like the girls and the little girls in that study, was always drawn to the white girls, the white Barbies. And I always wanted to know why. And I was like, and I didn't understand why. Cause, you know, if I was her, I would totally want all the black Barbies. I would want all of them, and I want the ones with the curly hair, and I want them in all the African tradition and garb and the regular stuff. But to me, my sister didn't want that. She wanted the white Barbies, the blonde hair, and it was long, and it always confused me. And I was like, I don't think me and my parents ever had a formal conversation about it, but I was like, Dad, why don't y'all get her all these Barbies? I was like, why doesn't Milan want these Barbies? And
And that was all, that all, I just remember that stood out for me. It was like just seeing my sister and how that, how our culture has like imprinted on her mind that early. Luckily, as my sister growing up now, she's gotten more black Barbies, and she now looks for more black Barbies, and she, and that's what she wants now. But I just remember that, that experience and like seeing it firsthand, being my own sister, that still lives with me.
I can remember one thing from my childhood. I remember looking at the television and looking at who was considered beautiful when I was growing up. And the girls that were considered beautiful when I was growing up were, of course, Halle Berry, who was half white. Jennifer Lopez, who is of the Euro Puerto Rican look. Who else? I mean, it's just Chili was considered really pretty, but she had that whole different look to her, that other type of look to her.
She got that nice hair.
Yeah, she got that nice baby hair. But, and then I remember Brandy came out of nowhere. Brandy came out of nowhere, and she came in hard with Moesha, and then all of a sudden there were Brandy dolls. There was actually a doll made after a black woman, a real black woman. And I can remember that being very, it was a little confusing to me. Like, when I was little, I didn't really see it as confusing, but now that I'm looking back on it, it was confusing because they were telling us all these lighter, fairer, softer, textured-haired women were the ones that were the most beautiful. And then this girl that comes out who is very black, she is nice and chocolate, and she has black features, but she's beautiful. She's beautiful enough to have a Barbie. She's beautiful enough to have lunchboxes and posters. And then Raven Simone came up and did it next, where she had the That So Raven dolls and lunchboxes and pencils and all that kind of stuff. And that, to me, was a shift. That was when I really considered, okay, black can actually be considered really beautiful. It doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be light or fair skin or have soft hair to be considered beautiful. And that's when it started to become more of like a whole encompassing thing for me as a young individual growing up, trying to develop what beauty really is, my perception of beauty and the perception of black as beautiful. It definitely started with Brandy and seeing that grow up, and that's just where I came from.
I think that's great that you had that experience, you know, seeing that, oh, you know, black dolls and these shows, Moesha and That's a Raven, that's great. But I guess I kind of see it differently. I see it as this is what they want us to see. This is what they have in the media. This is what they want us to see. You remember Moesha was, you know, she was a pretty smart girl, right, if I can remember. She was pretty smart. But she had that ditzy best friend who was pretty chunky, and her mom, they was, you know, they had like, you know, oh, they, what was the friend's name? What was her name? I don't remember her name. But, you know, they were kind of, they were kind of ratchet. Okay, thank you.
Kim and Niecy,
yes. Mm-hmm. They were kind of ratchet. And then That's So Raven, that was on Disney, and Raven was very like, oh, just all kinds of places, you know. I feel like that's what the media wanted us to see, and that's other people who are not black are seeing this as well, and they're looking at this as, oh, this is what black people act like. So I kind of, at the time, I was like, okay, it's black people on TV, that's nice, but now I look back and I'm like, it's black people on TV acting the way that white people are telling us to, you know.
Even with the code, I think you'd associate characteristics with skin tone pretty much. I remember the Proud Family, mm-hmm. was my most favorite, something my sister grew up on pretty much.
Right.
You saw basically the sense and Penny Proud and whatnot, and ironically played by a much darker tone, Kyla Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see Dejanay, the flamboyancy in her, and that kind of intimidated most of the, I call the global minority pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw that pretty much, but in terms, I see my little sister now, and I see a product of it, like, she's now a hair designer, and apparently, like, she loves all the natural things now. Just, like, she does experiment with all hairstyles, but, man, she doesn't mind having natural hair when it comes down to it, pretty much. I remember also when she was introduced to music, one of her favorite artists included the likes of Mary J. Blige, Lauryn Hill, so.
No, I definitely think you're on. I mean, if you look at who, by and large, who has controlled the media for a long, long time, you know that there are. We should know that there are what they would deem acceptable versions of blackness that they're going to put out there. And I keep coming back to this man, but you know it's you know there's so many things that, you know, existed around him. But there was a documentary that was made in the 50s called The Hate That Hate Produced, and it was made by CBS. At the then time, like, even they were known as, like, a liberal outlet, you know, for that time. And to show you, as Malcolm said so many times, there's very little difference between white liberals and white conservatives. White liberals, you know, they're like wolves in sheep's clothing. You know, they'll say they're going to do this for you, but they're really not trying to upend their power structure in any shape, form, or fashion either. And so you have folks, you know, Mike Wallace, you know, doing this documentary. And the documentary was to drum up, you know, this fear of Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, and to drum up this fear and to put it out there to Middle America, which is code for, like, white America. And it worked like a, you know, and even when you look at the title, The Hate That Hate Produced, not the community organizer that hate produced, because if racism in America the way it was never existed, we're not talking about Malcolm today. This kind of environment produces a Malcolm X. Just like when you look at women leaders that emerge, they emerge because there's a need for women leaders to emerge, because if things were all equal, you know what I'm saying, and women were getting paid, you know, the same money for the same work, you know. There's no need for a woman, you know, leader of that magnitude to come up and to fight for equality. What are you fighting for? Equality? You have it. You know what I'm saying? So, even when looking at mainstream hip hop, I mean, I want to turn it over to you, but when you look at even mainstream like hip hop, corporate hip hop, these are clearly acceptable versions of blackness that they want to put out there, because if you are a hip hop head, you know that there are some very, very extremely dope, wickedly talented MCs, men and women, that are out there right now that are not being played. And if you look at what they're saying, it completely spits in the face of the stereotypical black rapper that we see trotting across the, you know. So, and even though, like, a lot of these rappers are not unintelligent, they're actually smart, but they're put into these positions where they accept these narratives and these roles. Okay, I'll dumb it down, and I'll ask, yeah, I got a college degree or even a master's degree, but I'll dumb it down, you know, to appease, you know, Jimmy Iovine and the rest of the higher ups of Interscope or Sony BMG, what have you. So, you just made I'm glad Janelle brought this up. Like, you just made a documentary that was based on a call, and I can't remember the exact name, but Diamond, can you talk about that and talk about, like, what Janelle, you know, prompted us to have this dialogue about in the first place on color. And folks, the black couple that did this, they were the psychologist that did this study was Kenneth and Mamie Clark, and they did it in the late 30s and early 40s around the black and white doll. But why did you do a documentary on colorism? Why? What was that about?
Well, first of all, the documentary is called Colorism, Destruction Within a Race. So if anybody wants to look that up, just search up colorism. You don't even have to put the whole name in it.
What's that again?
It'll pop up on the first page. Colorism, Destruction Within a Race. So what prompted me to do the documentary is probably based off of my own experience. So it's something that I'm passionate about, because it's something that I've had to face. I wouldn't necessarily say my whole life, but probably up until, like, I got to middle school is when I started experiencing it. And I realized that I am different, I guess, because I am of a darker complexion. And it was very much thrown at my face. I at that point, I had to realize that I was darker, and also that apparently to other people, to everybody around me, it wasn't pretty. It wasn't something that was beautiful. It was ugly. So, and I really had to think about why that is. Like, I was curious as though why is something such as a skin complexion something that is so important to me? Like, it's not like my character. It's not how nice I am, it's not how educated I am, it's nothing. It's none of the above. It has nothing to do with who I am as a person. So why is it such, why is it so important to you, and why does that make me ugly, you know? So, and I realize it's something that people don't really talk about at all. There's not a lot, an extensive amount of talk or discussion as to why people make fun of you. You know, it's just, you just get the bickering and just the people talking to you behind your back and in front of your face and mocking you. So when I joined UNITV Media, that was the first thing that came into my mind was colorism, because it is a suppressed issue in society. So I decided to interview people around campus and also a little off campus at the nearby mall. And to be honest, a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. A lot of people, you know, they had nothing to say. So out of all the footage that I had, I probably had to cut out about 50% of it, because people just were like, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what colorism is. And some of them were very dark people. Some of them were African. One African guy at BG Plaza was like, what are you talking about? What is that? What is colorism? Mm. People make fun of that, like, you know, so, which is interesting. And I think also some people kind of gave me something that wasn't really true. I don't know. That's just based off of my experience with them. But, you know, oh, yeah, I love dark people. I love this. I love that. Yeah. But, anyway, so interviewing people was it was an eye-opener. It was just different people's experience. Even light-skinned people. I've had light-skinned people say, oh, I get discriminated heavily because I was light-skinned by dark-skinned people and vice versa.
Wow.
So it's definitely prevalent in society, and I think that has to be a constant talk point, because it is crazy, because just 2 nights ago, I had somebody in my family call me and say, hey, my son just said he wants to bleach his skin.
Wow. Are you serious?
Yeah. So when I talk to him, it's kind of like, there's still not that consciousness there. So I'm like, you want to bleach your skin? He's like, no, I just said that I wanted to get some facial cleanser to make my skin lighter. So I just want a facial cleanser to get the darkness off my skin, because I used to be light when I was a baby. So I want to go back to that. When I was taller, I used to be lighter. And it turns out, like, she's from, like, your complexion. She's not even, you know, I wouldn't call him dark skin. So, and it was just like, wow, the fact that I'm so close to you, and it's something that I take very seriously, and something that I've done a lot of research on, and the fact that it's right under my nose.
Yeah.
It's so sad. It's like a slap in the face because of what I've experienced.
Right.
And the fact that your mother's dark skin, I'm dark skin, everybody's your family dark skin. So, like, the hate just based off the tone of your skin is crazy.
I remember when I first came to Solomon to speak to him about the media initiative, the first thing I said was, I would love to do something on colorism. And you told me you already did, and I was like, darn. But the reason why I wanted to do it was basically the complete opposite. My family comes from a Creole background, and it's very, very light. I have people in my family that pass for white. And it was the elders, the older generations, not my mother's generation, not my grandmother's generation, but like my great-grandparents' generation and their generations before them, were very hardcore about keeping dark out of the family. You don't mix with anybody darker than you. You don't bring somebody black into the house. You don't bring a nigga into the house.
Really?
You don't do this. You don't do that. There were so many don'ts, and there were so many stigma surrounded around it, to the point where I literally, they're still alive. I have people in my family that are still alive where they might come out dark, because Creole people were just a mix of a lot of white and black and Caribbean and all this kind of stuff. You can come out looking anything, where your parents can both be very light, but you can come out dark just by virtue of what you are. And I have a cousin who, all of her siblings are very light, very fair, and she came out dark. dark with very soft hair. She's very beautiful. Was one Miss Chicago when she was younger, but she was known as the dark one in the family.
Wow.
And we have, and like when you bring home babies in like communities like that, they'll look at the tips of their ears, and that's like a tell for if your baby's gonna be dark. And not even dark, they can come out like being my complexion, which is more like a caramel complexion, but like if the tips of the ear is like has just a little bit of darkness, oh, that's gonna spread. They'll tell the parents, oh, that's gonna spread. You're kinda dark. Oh, man, it's kinda like there was a stigma around it. But I remember, I don't remember because I wasn't there, but I know my grandmother talked to me about this, my great aunt, who's her sister, talked to me about this. They, in their generation, they grew up in the Malcolm X era of Afrocentric, Black Panther, Chicago. I'm African American, and this is what I want to do, and this is who I am, and all this kind of stuff. So they became very, very Afrocentric, to the complete horror of my great grandparents. But I mean, it stems from that, and to me, it's kind of crazy knowing this about my family. Like, I deal with this within myself. Like, this is where I come from. I come from a family that actually felt some type of way about people to the point where they would, like, segregate them on purpose. They wouldn't even consider themselves from the same community. They wouldn't even consider themselves, like, the same type of people. And it was purely based off of ignorance and skin tone and all of that. And that is just not right. And I'm sorry that it's like that. I am. And I'm not very light either, so I'm not saying this like, but I'm just sorry that it's like that for darker complexion people, that they have to feel this type of way, and that there is such thing as a light skin complex or a dark skin syndrome, or, you know, things like this just shouldn't exist, but they do because of generations past that gets passed down.
Pretty much on point. I'm pretty much, basically, I'm no stranger to this light skin versus dark skin thing in my home continent, Nigeria. And like, I'm hearing as the number one supplier in terms of skin bleaching products in Africa. There is this star in Cameroon named Densia that is basically the poster child for skin bleaching. I'm thinking to myself, why would you need to lighten up your skin for? Like, I just find it unnecessary to change who you actually are, pretty much. So one of my examples was, I have an experience where we took a trip to Orlando in the middle of the summertime, and if we know anything about Florida, it's hot outside. So when we came, but basically I see people in my family like just all over on that sunscreen. They didn't want to get sunburned. They didn't want their skin to go darker and pretty much whatnot. I think myself, like, you only put on sunscreen if it was over 100 degrees. It never went up like that at all, not even in the Miami area. So going back home, like, going back to the school year, my sister asked me, like people asked me, why did I become darker over the summer and whatnot. I'm thinking to myself, it's kind of ignorant thinking that, like, what's with the changes getting? It doesn't change the person. Your outward appearance just does not change the person. Mm-hmm. And that's how I define beauty nowadays. Like, what I see inside, I can look past the future characteristics and features and thinking, what are you? What are you personally? What are you? What are your traits?
Yeah, I always hated that about people when they would say stuff like, well, I don't want to go that place because, like, I'm using pop because I don't get black.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who was very, very, very light, to pass for white. And I remember being in high school, we used to catch the bus, and one time we went to the bus stop, but she was like, oh, Diamond, I'm going to get black. We need to hurry up. I'm going to get black. I'm going to get crispy. Like, I'm like, what are you talking about? You can probably get a little red, but you can't get black. Like, you're like, you know, like, and it's crazy that you're trying to, like, she really hiding her face. And this was like, this wasn't just a one-time thing. This is an ongoing thing, and it's something that I've seen a lot. Or people are like, my brother was like, you know, I'm going to play football now. You know, when summer starts, you know, how can I protect my skin complexion? How can I stop myself from getting dark? Sunscreen, you know, I'm like, no. That's a misconception. People think that sunscreen will stop you getting darker. It's not. It's just to protect you from UV rays or cancer. You're still gonna get darker. Like, and I always ask people who are lighter, who say like, who say stuff like, I don't want to get darker because the sun and stuff. I always say to myself, well, what if you were born dark? What if you were actually born that complexion? Then what? Mm-hmm. Would you hate yourself then because you wouldn't be able to get lighter when summer ended?
Being Caribbean, my Trinidad one is a melting pot. There are Asian people in Trinidad, Indian people in Trinidad. It's all the color spectrum ranges from super, super, super light to super, super, super dark. You know, so that's on my mother's side of the family. We have all different complexions. My father's side of the family, it's different complexions as well. It's lighter tone people to darker tone people. My siblings, both my sisters are both lighter than myself. My brother's way, way lighter than me. On my father's side, my other sisters, they're way, way lighter too. But I'm probably the darker one. I think I'm even maybe a smidge darker than my mother. I never really, growing up as a child, I never really experienced, you're too dark or stuff like that. No, it wasn't until maybe middle school when rappers and we would hear stuff like, I got me a little red bone, like stuff like that, you know? And it was like, red bone, that's a lighter-skinned girl, right? Red bone with long hair. And I'm just like, okay. At first, you know, people didn't take that seriously, whatever, and then you see it on MySpace and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And it'd just be like, all right, okay, that's cool. And then you'd go to schools and people be like, I want a light-skinned girl, all this kind of stuff. And you'd be like, I got a crush on him, but, he only dates light-skinned girls. Girl, you didn't know? Oh, okay. And I'm sitting over here. I'm kind of chalk. I'm a mocha girl, and I love my complexion. You know, I think I'm just super beautiful. But when I was younger, it was kind of just like, dang, like, yeah, I am pretty dark, ain't I? Huh. But I feel like it's just, you just have to accept yourself. And it's horrible that we have so many individuals who still just think that they're ugly because of their skin tone or because of their hair texture, stuff like that, you know? Oh, gosh, it's a problem.
Well, basically, if I wanted to appear, basically me being darker skin, it's, like I said, it's kind of ignorant that I would have ever heard that, even in high school, never thought of that. But basically now, even in Nigeria, if there's anything that's more embraced in Nigeria than anywhere in America, it's hip-hop music, pretty much. And there's one of the biggest stars out there by the name of P-Square. He collaborates with Rick Ross, and he titles Beautiful Onyinye. Onyinye is basically known as God's gift. And guess what? The feature shows a light-skinned girl. Why?
Just last night, I got on Instagram, and I ran into this girl whose Instagram name was Redbone Ayana. And she's in college. you know, it's not even an age thing. It's not like you're old enough to know better, and your name is Redbone Ayana. Then her bio. And her bio had the nerve to say something like, yeah, pretty red bitch from Atlanta.
Ooh.
You're like, so I'm like,
her
bio means your bio is when you talk about yourself, and you know, it's the first thing you see when you go to somebody's Instagram.
Describe yourself.
Like, yeah, describe yourself. That's her description of herself.
Oh.
Pretty red bitch.
Okay, I would just go on and say that that's not, don't let that speak for Atlanta. don't let that speak for Atlanta.
It's everywhere. Yeah. And then she had the red hair all the way down. I had to go through her pictures. I had to see what this girl was about. So I'm looking at her pictures, stuff like, yeah, you know, it was like her real hair. She had real hair on one picture, and she was like, and she was like, can't wait to get this 30 inches back in.
Y'all about to have this girl hollering at.
And then she's shouting out people, like, everybody she shout out, had something to do with how they look. She got a friend named Kendra, who's like the one person that I know, and she's like, love my chocolate girl. I love my, this is my chocolate bitch right here, like, blah, blah. And then I saw another shout out. She was like, I love my bathroom where I mixed ass, because she was like, she was mixed.
Mm-hmm.
She was like some kind of, you know, like probably white and black, I think. So I'm like, wow, this is going to be our pictures. It was just so much ignorance. I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
You clearly don't have any respect for yourself, because every picture you're calling yourself a bitch. Like, I don't understand.
Right.
Going off of that, that's just ignorance, and it's actually quite sad. We're sitting and we're laughing and we're blown by this, but it's actually pretty sad because what that says is that that girl doesn't know anything else that's of any substance or value that she can, like, if you put that in your bio about yourself, she didn't say anything about going to school. She didn't say, I mean,
she ran track. She has so many involved in a lot of stuff, but that's the one sentence in her bio.
That's what I'm saying. That's where she holds her value, though. And that's kind of sad, because that means that she probably has a little self-esteem.
Yeah.
If that's the way you refer to yourself, if you refer to yourself as a bitch in the first place, and then you refer to yourself as a red-boned bitch, even if she was light-skinned, that's just not somewhat, I would never really refer to myself as this nice, scared man tone bitch over here. Like, that just would never do it.
Pretty much your complexion. Like you said, that's where she held our value, in her skin complexion. And I also saw from her body, because a lot of pictures were, like, naked, you know, butt poking out, like, yeah, pretty red girl, get at me, like, and then there'll be stuff like, then this is probably a little bit off, but it'll be pictures like, I'm so lonely, I'm so single, but just for attention, because there's a whole long list of guys come and like, thirst traps, what they call it now, thirst trap.
Redbone, Ayana.
It was something like that.
Redbone, Ayana, that's a whole nother radio show, because she got other issues. But going off of what Tatiana said earlier about growing up and being of a chocolate skin tone and having her family be lighter, it reminded me of my younger brother, and my younger brother came out very milk chocolate, very, very chocolatey. And he grew up looking at us like, wow, there's obviously a difference here.
Wow.
And from, like, ever since he could understand, my mom's been telling him the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice, the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice. And my brother went through maybe like a very, very, very tiny stage of being self-conscious about his skin color. But my entire family made sure to tell him, like, no, you look good. You will not have trouble finding somebody to love you. You will not have trouble finding somebody to accept you. You are handsome. You are this. The blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice. And that's the way, and that's all you got to remember. And so, I mean, that's just what listening to Tatiana made me think about.
Again, I feel like this all stems from the media.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we have actresses, actors. Most of the black actors and actresses we see all the time are light-skinned. You know what I'm saying? We probably have, okay, I'd say we have a few more dark-skinned actresses out there. But as far as everything we see, they're all pretty, you know, fair-toned or high, you know, higher up. Lupita, we got to talk about her, y'all. We got to talk about her. And I, you know, going on Twitter during the Oscars, people were like, why is everybody so hyped? And guess what?
Nyong'o.
Okay. Thank you, Mamadou. Thank you. So, yeah, on Twitter we see. Oh yeah, everybody. Oh yes, good girl. You know, we happy for her. And yes, I will go ahead and say I am proud of her, because guess what? That's a dark skinned chick that won an Oscar. Okay. Okay. Yeah, she's from London or whatever. Whatever. She's Kenyan, right? But
yeah.
she was like, she grew up in London. Mm-hmm. She went to school in London. Okay, that's great. But guess what? She's still a dark-skinned chick.
Beautiful.
You know what I'm saying? Guess what? These white people don't know that, oh, she's Kenyan. She went to school here. No, none of that. They see her as a black girl. You know what I'm saying? And I'm glad. I'm glad that we finally have somebody out there that's representing us.
Yeah. Going off of that, I can literally remember vividly a conversation in middle school talking with my friends, and there was some dark girls and there were some light girls, and I remember the dark girls were coming at the, like, they were, like, basically attacking the light-skinned girls, even though we were all friends, basically saying, like, you don't understand our struggle, you don't understand this, and we were like, what do you mean, we're all black, and then they broke it down for us, and they broke it down in a way that I never really thought of as, like, a 12-year-old. They were saying, when I look in the magazine, who do I see? Even when I look in Ebony, who do I see? I see nobody that looks like me. I see nobody that looks like me. I see nobody that I can look up to. all I see are these girls like Beyonce and such that look like you. And so it's kind of like, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for me? If I'm looking and all I see is your skin complexion or somebody that looks like you, that means that I'm not good enough to go into a magazine. That means that I'm not good enough to go on television. And I remember I was like, so think about like people like Monique or Gabrielle Union, and they're like, they're just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then Monique is fat, and so she's a joke. She's a joke. And I can remember just being like, I remember being kind of hurt by that. Like, I never really thought about it. I never, until it was brought into my attention, but I remember being hurt from my friends because after thinking about it, you didn't see dark people. The media did not put that out there. And I could see where that'd be really, really hurtful to somebody that was of a chocolate skin complexion, because I can understand where they're coming from. Why am I not good enough to go into the magazine?
Yeah, people say that there are like a couple more black actresses now, and they say, well, there are more dark actresses now.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, they're talking about Gabrielle Union or Nia Long or actors like that. But for me, that's not even dark. Like, I'm like people say stuff like that, but and I'm looking at myself like they're still like it's still not really that much progress, because you're still talking with somebody of a lighter complexion. Like, so that's why I appreciate Lupita Nyong'o, you know, coming out and, you know, people embracing her, but at the same time, people are looking at her like, oh, she's exotic, you know, she looks exotic, so that's why people are accepting her. When you do have dark actresses like, I'm trying to think, what is that lady's name? I can't think of anybody's name right now, but there are some really dark actresses that aren't as sensationalized because they're just black or they're not as pretty as her. So, yeah.
I feel like this is just also, it's really big in the black community. You know, we're putting, and this is hatred, honestly, this dark skin versus light skin, you know, it's hatred amongst ourselves. So we're just doing their job, and when I say their, I mean white people, their job for them. You know, we're over here, it's a joke on Twitter and on Instagram, team light skin, team dark skin. No, it's not a joke, guys. Like, this is serious. We need to stop the ignorance. We have to. And just like Solomon was saying, we need to carry this conversation out to the dorm, out to the dining hall, out into the public, so, you know, our friends can hear about it. And not only are our friends hearing about it, somebody out there is going to overhear you speaking, talking about this, and they'll continue it.
Mm-hmm. Going off of that, I think also really important to like put it out there, like the light skin complex kind of it just blows me right now, because I feel like light skin people are the main ones putting dark skin people down right now with the whole light skin complex. Like, I'm obvious, I get like 2 extra points just for being light skin. Like, if I was darker, I would look this good, because I'm light, I look even better type thing. And that's just not right to me, actually, because me personally, my preference is darker skin guys. I like chocolate. But to me, I don't think it's right for these guys and these girls to walk around just thinking that just because they came out fairer, that means that they're prettier or that they have a one-up on darker skin people. I just don't, because in reality, the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice sometimes. You know what I mean?
I've heard their notion that light skinned girls just look better, but and this might sound ignorant, but I think I'll be light skinned girls.
I'm light skinned girls.
So what are you saying? I don't understand.
Like I said,
the hatred needs to stop. It really does. I really don't get it. Like, it makes me wonder, when will it end? Like, when?
You know, you're not your roommate. The girl across the hall from you, that white girl, that Asian girl, whatever, she's not seeing, oh, no, she's a Trinidadian. Oh, no, she's Nigerian. Oh, no, she's Kenyan. She's that kind of black. No, she's a black girl. You know, oh, no, she's light-skinned. No, she's black. That's how people see us. So why are we classifying ourselves all these kind of different ways? Heritage is a whole different story. So maybe I shouldn't have said, oh, you know, Kenyan, Nigerian, but still, they don't see that when they look at us. You know, me, I can tell that you are African. I could tell that you're Nigerian. You know, there's a distinct way, your face is distinct. But other people, they're not going to be able to tell that. So why are we classifying ourselves as so many different things?
One time we had a debate about this whole skin color thing in my high school. In front of my art teacher, we were all black, my art teacher was white. Mm. And she wasn't really listening, but then she kind of chimed in and she was like, wait a minute. She was like, y'all all just black. Like, y'all look black to me. She was like, let me tell you what white people see. She was like, let me see what white people see. We were all different shades. She said, black. And I always make the joke that, like, if the Ku Klux Klan came in this room, that's they killed all of us. What things you are? We all going down. They're not going to say, oh, don't kill her because she's your picking. Don't kill her because she got a little thing in her family. We all face the same struggle. Mm-hmm. So why are we bringing each other down? We're fighting each other, and it makes no sense whatsoever. It really doesn't. And I wish people would have that consciousness and really educate themselves on it, because I feel like if more people understood it, understood like the history and all that, maybe they look at people differently, mm-hmm. you know. But a lot of us are just ignorant.
Yeah.
That's actually a good note to end on, because show's about to close. But you know, just the one thing I'll say is, you know, Tatiana, when you said they're pitting, you know, lighter skinned, you know, blacks versus darker skinned blacks, you're right, it's not a game, because this was done in places like Burundi. It was done in places like Rwanda and the Belgians, you know, and in different countries, even in parts of Kenya, where they would not just split up different, you know, ethnic groups, you know, so-called tribes, they're different ethnic groups, but they would split up based on lighter and darker, you know, and it's that term called divide and conquer, and if you don't have unity, so that's why it's a good point to end on, is if you don't have unity, then they can divide and conquer. But if we're coming together like this, even though we might have, a different perspective on things, you know what I'm saying, Janelle and I, but we come together like this. That's why we're doing this thing. We come together like this, and you can't break in. So once this is done, and somebody comes and says, oh, you disagree with Janelle, I said, nah, that sister and I, we're good. We're on the same page. We're going in the same direction. Mm-hmm. If you got that, you got that unity, they can't break it. So, you know, folks that are listening right now, you know, this, I'm surrounded by brilliance, whether it's Muftal, Diamond, Malik, Janelle, Tatiana, we just met today. This is brilliance. These are young brothers and sisters that are quite honestly following in the footsteps of our brilliant ancestors. And I'm so, I feel so honored to be amongst these five students right now. And on that note, I guess, because once again, you had a great idea. I think perhaps the next show after spring break, you were talking about the movies or something like that. Weren't you talking about,
Yeah, I was having a conversation with somebody in our dorm hall, and they didn't know what school days was, and that blew me to, like, the edge of the earth, basically. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait, that's a very crucial turning point in black media history. Mm-hmm. That's one of Spike Lee's greatest, most well-known, and for us as in my generation, for people in my generation not to know what that is, especially because we're in college.
Mm-hmm.
It just, to me, I just wanted to talk about, like, black media history and movies in particular, and where we're going in the media industry as a community, where we are, not the white men, but where we are making movies, where we are producing, like, Marv, Rock Akil, Spike Lee, Will Packer, people like that. We are there. It's just that we're not there a lot because we don't get support. People don't know who we are.
And that's a great idea. And madam, producer, can we also, part of that discussion, talk about movies that we'd like to see made in the future?
Yes,
you know?
Of course.
The Haitian Revolution movie or something?
Of course. Of course. That's actually one of my passions. I would love to be a black female movie producer. I would love to do that. So give me ideas. Call it and give me ideas. I love it.
All right. So on behalf of the student scholars and co-hosts, I'm Solomon Kamajan for Your World News, and That was Nellie Netterville, student producer for United TV Media. We had Tatiana in the house, my brethren from the great island nation of Trinidad.
Yes, yes.
Where the term Pan-Africanism came from, Henry Sylvester Williams. Malik, my Southern Californian brother, Diamond, holding down Charm City. Muktau, coming straight out of Nigeria. This has been Your World News and United TV Media, and I owe Janelle one because I thought I had Nas Ican in the queue, but I'll have that for next time. So here's an oldie but goodie that should tie us down until the next show. This is BDP, led by KRS-One, You Must Learn.
Genesis chapter 11, verse 10, explains the genealogy of Shem. Shem was a black man in Africa. If you repeat this fact, they can't laugh at you.
Yeah, guys.
14, verse 13.
What are you doing?
Associates of thousand years of ignorance, stupidity, and tears. Now comes the 17th century hardness. Europe began to come out of its darkness. Some Johann F. Blumenbach, a German, came out of nowhere and started confirming white supremacy and men of color. Before this time, all men were brothers. It was Johann who went on to say, there are five different colors in the world today. That's Caucasian, Malayan, and Mongolian, American Indian, and Ethiopian. Yes, the ignorance gets scarier. He believed white was superior. According to his idiotic fountain, the purest whites were from the Caucasus Mountains. J.A. Governor and H.S. Chamberlain both supported this outrageous racism. This went on to what the master race should be and why they killed the Jews in Germany. Here is the reason why I'm so concerned, because you must learn. We're not done. We're not done. We're not done. Check this out.